Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Welcome back to the Gay Buddhist Fellowship. It's nice to see such a full house on such a wet day. So our tradition is we go around and introduce ourselves first, and then I'll introduce our speaker. My name's Tom.
Robert.
Kenny,
Rich,
John,
Max,
John,
Lee,
my name is Mark,
Harley,
I'm Philip,
Mike,
Peter,
Richard,
I'm Henry,
Michael,
David,
Jack,
I'm Derek,
Jeff,
Tage,
Mitch,
I'm Hal,
Tonton,
Joe,
Richard,
Elliot,
Jose,
Patrick,
I'm David,
I'm Jerry,
Ray,
Peter,
Jim,
I'm Sean,
I'm Ed,
Nick,
Dan.
Great. So we have the privilege of hearing again from Dale Bortles. Dale is the founder and executive director of the Living Dying Project. He is a pioneer in the conscious dying movement and has worked directly with thousands of people with life-threatening illness and their families for over 30 years. In 1981, Dale founded the first residential facility in the United States for people who wish to die consciously. He has taught and lectured extensively on the topics of spiritual support for those with life-threatening illness, caregiving as a spiritual practice, and healing at the edge of illness, of death, of loss, of crisis. Dale is the co-author of Journey of Awakening, a meditator's guidebook, and has taught meditation for the past 35 years. Dale, welcome.
Thank you. It's a true pleasure to be back, seeing so many people that were here when I was here in August. I don't remember exactly what I talked about last time, so we'll see how different it is this time. But I would like to focus on compassion, which in some ways is the center of the spiritual path. Compassion literally means with passion. And I think here in the West, we often mistake compassion as feeling soft and open to the suffering of others, when in truth, compassion is often a very, very warrior-like attitude towards life. Compassion really means the ability to equalize and switch yourself with another being. So if in any moment you or I feel that we are better or worse than the person or people that we are relating to, then in that moment compassion becomes impossible. To generalize that, in fact, in the East, compassion is often taught as a practice in working with the suffering of other people. In the West, it's really crucial to extend that practice to ourselves, compassion for self. Let me read a short poem by Rumi. Whoever finds love beneath hurt and grief disappears into emptiness with 1,000 new disguises. So, Buddhists often don't talk about love. We talk about that quality of emptiness. But Rumi talks about grief being the garden of compassion. If, in fact, we can be with those feelings of separation, which are the essential quality of grief, if we can begin to work with that feeling of separation, the separation we feel from ourselves, the feeling of separation we feel from each other in this room at this moment, and the feeling of separation from the one source, Christ consciousness, Buddha nature, whatever we want to call that, then separation can be transmuted into the feeling of connection, which is compassion. These Buddhist practices that many of us have been doing for shorter or longer periods of time were developed by and for people who were unneurotic, grounded and centered, and loved their mother and their father. If we look around the room, how many of those people do we see? So, before we can really find the deeper fruit that is why we are doing this practice, it is necessary to become present, to become grounded and centered in this moment, become embodied, even though we have all lost a lot. And beyond that, then, to begin to work with the patterns that arise as we become present. There are many different reasons and goals in meditation practice. I think probably most of us began to meditate because we didn't want to suffer so much. We wanted to be a little bit happier, maybe having a little easier time making money and finding love in our lives. We read books that said that you could get enlightened if you worked really, really, really hard, and there are inspiring stories of great saints who lived in caves for interminable periods of time, and Milarepa, for instance, turned green because he lived on nettle tea for so long. Probably nobody in this room is going to turn green from drinking only nettle tea. But I would suggest that after having practiced myself for about 40 years now, that enlightenment isn't some faraway thing. It isn't some glorious, difficult thing to achieve that only those who completely dedicate their lives and renounce the world and go into a cave or climb to the top of a mountain can achieve. But it really is a very simple, in fact, so profoundly simple practice that it is so easy to miss. Can we have enough compassion for what is exactly going on in this moment? In this moment, the patterns in our mind and our body that keep distracting us from being present, destabilizing the mind. Can we begin to find enough stable mind and body so that we can begin to see that, begin to experience in our bodies, begin to smell, to taste, that what we are is not this changing content of experience, but that in fact we are the very nature of experience. In Buddhism, there's a quality called, a concept, egolessness. And I think there's a very common mistake in assuming that that means we have an ego, and by practicing enough, we will come to a place of egolessness by purifying and eventually destroying this ego. But what Buddhism is really saying is that there is no such thing as an ego. It's just an illusion. It's just a collection of thoughts in our mind. That we are intrinsically pure, untainted. We are love. We are compassion. Compassion is our true nature. And that when we begin to rest with a stabilized mind in the present, that is what appears. So that might have been a confusing sentence because I was really spelling compassion in two different ways in the same sentence. There's compassion with a small c that's a practice that we do. In this moment, what is it in your mind, in your body, that is arising that keeps you from being fully present with me, with us, with what's going on here? But compassion can also be spelled with a capital C. That is our true nature, empty of self. Compassion has three defining qualities: emptiness, spaciousness. Emptiness or spaciousness, two words for the same thing. Connectedness and warmth. Emptiness means emptiness of a grasping self. And when I was saying before that enlightenment is something that isn't that far away, there are literally thousands and thousands of moments in your day and my day in which we are resting in that non-grasping place. You're walking from your car through the rain to come to the front door. You're feeling the rain on your face. You're hearing the sound of your feet walking through the puddle. And that's all that's going on. A pure moment, a moment of enlightenment. Then you start wondering, okay, am I getting too wet? Are my shoes going to get ruined? These are my best shoes. Why did I wear them on a day like this? Whatever, the whole story begins. Whoever finds love beneath hurt and grief disappears into emptiness with a thousand new disguises. So we can be fixated at that level of hurt and grief. We've all lost a lot, as I said before. This community of men has lost more than a lot of other communities have lost, certainly. And from a very human perspective, we can get lost in that hurt and grief. Can instead we use it to rip open our hearts? Is it possible that the very hurt is what inspires us to be more open than before that moment that we were experiencing the hurt? Now, we've all heard that spiritual trite saying, pain makes you stronger, and it probably has made you want to throw up as often as it has wanted to make me throw up. At the same time, in that moment where you become awake and feel the resistance in your body, the tightness in your belly, the slight raising of your shoulders, the tightness in your voice. In that moment, what is your response? Can you come back to being present with mercy, with compassion for yourself? Or is there some violence? Is there some criticism? Is there some judgment? However subtle, some jerking, some yanking back. You're not a very good meditator today. Your voice is saying to some other part of yourself, look at that guy next to you. He's sitting so still, and here you are, restless, moving about, waiting for the bell to ring. When is that damn bell going to ring? So in that moment, in that period at the end of the meditation, when your body's getting restless, thoughts are beginning to jumble and fly all over the place, maybe that is a more productive meditation period than earlier, when there was that period of serendipity where everything sort of fell into place and everything was quiet for a little while. In some traditions, they talk about the 75%, 25% rule, in which 75% of your attention is brought to this inner surrender, dying into yourself. And 25% is looking out into the world. There's a red light, I should stop. I was just telling a couple people here that I know who know a friend of mine who 2 days ago got killed in a motorcycle accident. Here's a guy on the big island of Hawaii driving his motorcycle, and from one moment to the next, he's happily there with a beautiful day in Hawaii, and 3 seconds later, he's dead. Somebody didn't yield right of way. When we hear a story like that, we all know intellectually that that could happen to us. We're all getting in cars or walking home or something, and we're in a big city and it's raining and things happen. But if we really, really knew that, that we were going to die but we didn't know when, if we really knew how precious life actually is, our one wild human life, then how would that change your hearing this next sentence, me hearing this next sentence? How would it change the next breath you're taking? How would it change your reaction to the next person that cuts you off in traffic, that's acting like a real asshole? Here's a quote from Kala Rinpoche. There is a reality. We are that reality. When we understand this, we will see that we are nothing. And being nothing, we are everything. That is all. There is a reality. We are that reality. When he's saying we are nothing, it means that this illusory self we're clinging to so tightly, trying to protect, to aggrandize, to improve, to manipulate, is really just a figment of our imagination. Can we find the courage? Can we find the love to drop back into being nothing? And trusting that at the bottom of all this Buddhist emptiness, there is this passionate, truly alive self with a capital S. So before I go on, let me ask if there are any comments or questions at this point.
So yeah. You mentioned that grief is the garden of compassion, both from Rumi. And then you talked about some of the characteristics of compassion. What's special about grief that opens us up to our true nature?
What is special about grief that opens up us up to our true nature? Grief is any negative emotion that arises in response to separateness. Usually we think of grief stereotypically as a sadness that arises because someone dies or a relationship ends. But in fact, grief is a wider definition than that. If you're angry because somebody cuts you off in traffic, that's a grief reaction. Because you're feeling separate from that human being. If you're feeling depressed, that's a grief reaction because you're feeling separate from self or from God. So that everyone is grieving. In any moment where you're not remembering or resting in presence, in true nature, we're feeling grief. There is this deep yearning in each of our hearts that Rumi talks about so exquisitely, Kabir, other poets. We've all felt that. We've all been in that place where we've been beyond grief, where we felt that connection, and depending on your particular flavor, that connection with God, with Christ, with Buddha, with self, with the beloved, with Shiva, with the mother. So one way of re-imaging the spiritual path is this transformation of separation to connectedness. All mystical spiritual teachings say that we are already enlightened. There is not something to find that isn't already here. What you are looking for is what is looking. So as long as we're sitting here thinking, I've got to fix my grief, I've got to become an enlightened person by doing this or by doing that, we're really pointed 180 degrees from the truth. Can we find that wholeness intrinsically, even in the feeling of separation? Can we let go of all this manipulation and fixing? And I'm hoping I'm not putting too many psychotherapists out of business here. I'm sure I'm not, actually. So that there are different stages of spiritual practice. And the first stage is stabilizing the body-mind enough that you can begin to touch the sense of wholeness. As long as the mind is jumping all over the place constantly, there isn't what's called access concentration, enough concentration to really begin to touch that radiance that is there even in grief. So in the beginning, we concentrate, we do shamatha practice, we watch the breath, we push things away, try to be with the breath, focus, work hard, and after some years or decades of that, depending how stubborn you are, we get to the place where the mind begins to calm down at least some of the time. The body begins to open up at least some of the time. And in that openness, compassion becomes a possibility. The heart, the nature of the heart, is revealed as the mind becomes willing to see each situation as workable. Not having to push away experience, opening to experience, and then our true nature of compassion begins to arise. And as we can be with this quality of compassion, as I mentioned before, one of the true defining qualities of compassion is spaciousness, emptiness of self. In this selflessness, then, the power of the divine, whatever you want to call that, begins to arise, and we can then rest in the non-dual state, where grief and non-grief, illness and wellness, even life and death, are just the faces of duality and aren't things that we have to become reactive to. So we can look around the room and see older, younger, bigger, smaller, male, male, more hair, less hair, all those differences. But can we look around the room and see that which is the same? But even more importantly, possibly, can we look inside of ourselves and, yes, there is a different content of experience in each moment. In some moments, you're hearing the sound of my voice. In another moment, you're feeling an itch and you're wanting to scratch it. In another moment, your knee hurts, so you're rearranging your legs. In another moment, your mind is wandering. All that changing of content of experience is truly happening. Is there something constant from moment to moment to moment? Like the thread on a string of beads. Is there presence, nature of mind, rigpa, that is the essential quality in each moment? And when you have the great blessing to be around somebody who is living in that place, who even though we're a Buddhist group here, supposedly, the beings I've been around who have found that place really seem to be resting in love. That another word for consciousness or radiance is love. That is our true nature. So that when we get not so busy reacting and can just rest in the moment, what is revealed is that we are love. Grief is the garden of compassion. Compassion is love meeting the suffering of the world. It's a garden. It's growing. Each time we're willing to touch our grief. Any other remarks or questions? Yes.
Every time we're willing to what, our grief?
To touch it without reacting, to be able to a moment of grief arises. There are three possibilities. One is pushing it away. I don't want to feel that. I don't want to get lost in that. I think I'm going to turn on the 49ers game. I think I'm going to have a beer. I think I'm going to have a bad love affair, whatever your choice of distraction happens to be. I'm going to push that away. Jim seems to like that one. Okay. Possibility number two. Grief arises. Instead of pushing it away, I'm going to get lost in it. Oh, my God, I'm a victim. This is horrible. What's going on? Why has God done this to me? Life is really a mess. Possibility number three, grief arises, and I am going to have a compassionate, warm, connected, spacious response to that experience. Now, the trick here is, maybe, let me cross that up. The work here is to be really, really flexible. Because what often happens is grief arises and you think, okay, I should be compassionate toward this grief, but you do that only partly successfully and you become critical of yourself. So at that point, the job is to be compassionate for the place in you that can't be compassionate in that moment. The place in you that's beating yourself up. It takes a great deal of humility and flexibility to keep bringing the practice into the present moment rather than trying to hook it up to what you're trying to do 5 seconds or 5 minutes or 5 weeks ago. To keep having that humility to admit that right now I'm not present. I'm wanting you to like me, whatever it might happen to be. You look a little bit still.
No, I'm just trying to analyze it too much.
So, I have a PhD in mathematics. I have a PhD in analyzing too much. Stanford said, you're great, we'll give you a PhD. And that really almost destroyed me. I mean, imagine going to Berkeley and Stanford for 10 years and studying mathematics, what that would do to somebody's mind. And probably most of you guys in this room make your living by being very good at making subtle distinctions as therapists or working in the IT industry or whatever it might happen to be. But we're using our minds in this very sophisticated way, and people are paying us to do that, which is a good, useful way to use your mind. The mind is a wonderful tool and a very lousy master. Is it possible, as well as being able to use the mind as a tool, to, when it's appropriate, to surrender beyond the mind again and again, to trust, not knowing, to trust the mystery? My teacher in India, this fellow Maharaji, had some very close relationship with Hanuman. Whether he was Hanuman or a great devotee of Hanuman, who knows? But Hanuman is the Hindu god that is the embodiment of selfless service, expressing devotion through the quality of service in the world. And it's said that Hanuman lives at the boundary between form and formless. So it's easy to get stuck in form. This is all real. There's bricks on the wall and there's wood on the floor and there's my voice in the air. And that's all there is. Or we can get lost in formless and just be surrendering into spaciousness and kind of get spaced out and be very Marin-like or whatever it is, and forget about making a living and getting stuck there. But is it possible to find this very fine balance between form and formless, where you're right on that edge? And I found that being around, quote, dying people, unquote, maybe they're not going to die, but just for the sake of languaging here, people who have a critical, life-threatening illness, that this balance I'm talking about is of crucial importance. It's possible to see somebody who may be approaching death as this human tragedy, to really deal with the humanity of it. They're dying, they're losing their mind, their body, all their stuff, everything they knew, everything's going to be gone. Or, on the other hand, it's possible to just be resting in the karmic perfection of the knowledge that everybody dies at the perfect moment. Can we keep both of those alive at the same time? Be right there at that balance of form and formlessness. Can we do that right now? 25% hanging out with this talk, what you're feeling in your body, 75% again and again surrendering back into that place that I can't even give words to in this moment. That place that is so intimate that it's like talking about our deepest love life. And in fact, can we trust that process of surrendering into that place can carry us through our life, that we don't have to be fixated in the outer world. We pay attention to it, we enjoy it, we serve, we feel gratitude, but a large part of our life is about our relationship with the beloved. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds like multitasking.
Well, it's like riding a bicycle. At first, it seems like, or driving an automobile. At first, when you're driving a car, it's hard to have a conversation, it's hard to have the radio on. There's so many things to think about, rules of the road, the brake, the whole thing. But after a while, you can be driving a car, having the radio on, and having a conversation, and the whole thing's happening at the same time. So, yes, there is a quality of self-consciousness that is an initial part of practice, where we're learning to disengage from what our popular culture is telling us is real and true, and trusting this quality of surrender. But eventually, then, it becomes second nature. Mayor Bob has said, love is contagious. Those who haven't got to catch it from those who do. And I will certainly say that in my own practice, that quality of surrender has become a possibility and something I can trust only because I have had the great grace to be around other people who are living that life, who have died into love. And in fact, that is why I choose to be around dying people. Because the most beautiful Americans I have been around are people who are almost dead. I'm sorry to tell you that. But they're willing to be themselves often. I mean, if you're almost dead, do you care if you're having a bad hair day? If you're almost dead, do you care if you're overweight? Or if your bank account is a little bit lower than you would hope? No. So, can we be with each other that way right now? How real can we be? How alive can we be? And it is that aliveness comes through that quality of surrender, trusting the intrinsic aliveness. So that Buddhism, in some ways, is kind of dry religion about life is suffering and there's the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. But there's a very passionate, alive understanding that is the underpinning of this whole project. And that is that if we let go into the moment, that there is an intrinsic movement toward wholeness and that we are whole, that we are enlightened already. And all we're doing is deconditioning. All we're doing is letting go of the subconscious mind's grasping at stuff that got conditioned when we were very small people, when we were powerless. We end up here at what, about 10-2, is that the idea?
Yeah, we have about 10 more minutes.
Okay. Let me read a quote from Sogyal Rinpoche. Our Buddha nature has an active aspect, which is our inner teacher. From the very moment we become obscured, this inner teacher has worked tirelessly for us, tirelessly trying to bring us back to the radiance and spaciousness of our true being. Not for one second has the inner teacher given up on us. In its infinite compassion, one with the infinite compassion of all the Buddhas and all the enlightened beings, it has been ceaselessly working for our evolution, not only in this life, but in all past lives. Using all kinds of skillful means and all types of situations to teach and awaken us and to guide us back to the truth. Trusting the inner teacher. There's a slogan in a Buddhist text, the text called Mind Training, the Tibetan Buddhist text. And the slogan is, drive all blames into oneself. Sounds like a rather kind of codependent thing. But what's really being said here is that we have a tendency to again and again blame the outside world for the way we feel. It's a rainy day today, so I feel this way, or I have a cold, or somebody wasn't nice to me, or I ate too much, or those damn Republicans, or whatever, you know, whatever it is. or those damn Democrats. But can we, again and again, drive the blame into ourselves in the sense of, in each moment, being completely responsible, being able to respond to what we're feeling? As soon as we put the blame outside, in that moment we're asleep. Imagine having a life in which moment to moment to moment we were with our own feelings without any sense of separating them by attaching them to external causation. Trusting the perfection of each moment. Sometimes it doesn't look very perfect, I admit. I have cancer. I just had a biopsy last week again. I have prostate cancer. I've been pissing blood. Every time I watch myself do that, I say, is this the perfect moment? Well, it doesn't always feel like it. And we, each of us, obviously have things in our life that are very easy to pull back from, to judge, to say, I really wish life were different. It's not different. This is exactly the way it is. Any other remarks?
I'd like to hear how you've been connected to this fact that you have cancer. I too have a diagnosis, and it would help me just to get a practical example of how you could be with that.
How do I connect with it?
Yeah, in equanimity.
I've had a lot of crises in my life over the years. I won't mention them. I'll get in trouble with friends and relatives if I do. But getting a PhD in math, having certain physical traumas when I was a child, having my life savings invested with Bernard Madoff, various things. And with each one of these crises, I reacted. I got lost in what the crisis brought up in me emotionally. And as my practice has deepened and evolved over the decades, each time I got better and quicker at saying, okay, here's what I'm feeling. How can I deal with this? So with the Madoff thing, it took me a few weeks, actually, to really, with humility, admit how terrified I was of becoming homeless and having a small child and what am I going to do with all this, and begin to have compassion for the place in me that was frightened. And when the doctor told me I had cancer, it took about an hour. Because, and even that hour was, it's like there's a lot of thinking, okay, what does that mean? What do I have to do? You know, a lot of planning and list making and stuff like that. So there's no special answer to your question. It really is why we call what we're doing practice. Compassion is not learned in the moment when the doctor says you've got cancer. Compassion is learned in the moment when you're sitting there meditating and you see that you're thinking about what's for lunch. How do you react to that moment? And how long does it take you? How far down the menu do you go before you say, oh, I'm not present now? And in that moment, then, do you beat yourself up and say, what a crappy meditator you are? Or can you come back with mercy and with kindness? And the more you can do that in those simple moments, then when my friend is flying through the air, seeing that his unhelmeted head is about to crash into this other vehicle or into the cement or whatever it was, I don't really know what happened exactly. In that moment where he sees that he's got a second to live, that's probably not the time to start practicing. So when people come to me and they have a terminal prognosis and they say, I'd like to learn to meditate now, often at that point it's a little bit late, because they're so, the emotions swirling around are so very strong that if you haven't learned to begin to practice with more day-to-day kinds of stuff, then the chaos, the storm of the crisis will be almost certainly overwhelming. So that's why you guys come together on a Sunday morning. That's why you go to retreats. That's why you do things like that. I have an ongoing group, four ongoing groups, two in Sebastopol, one in Marin, one in Berkeley. There are flyers about that called Healing at the Edge, where we work with grief, cancer diagnosis, just the stuff of life. How can we use meditation as a way of healing that stuff that arises as we find ourselves on an edge? And also, there are other flyers in January. I'm going to be teaching a two-day workshop in Berkeley that kind of summarize all that stuff in a two-day format. Other quick, Jim, yeah.
Do you think, you seem to have suggested that it does, people who have spent time in that dimension of surrender and spaciousness do not find the idea of death so threatening or strange?
For the tape here, do people who have spent time in spaciousness and surrender find death not so frightening and strange? Mm-hmm. Yes. There was a survey done of fear of death, a study, and they gave the test to doctors, ministers, meditators, and psychedelic drug takers. A bit of a setup. And doctors and ministers were significantly more afraid of dying than people who had meditated or people who had taken psychedelic drugs. Because basically, we're talking about how afraid are you of losing control? And being a doctor is probably teaching you to be in control, not be comfortable in letting go of control. Yeah.
So I've been a volunteer in Zen Hospice for a while, as I know other people here have also. And what I've noticed, there's a piece of sort of disagreement with what you said, that's pretty minor, is that they don't necessarily seem to lose interest in their hair and how their fingernails are and, you know, how they look and those things. And the people who seem to have the easiest time are the ones who've accepted that they're dying. The ones who are in emotional discomfort are the ones who are trying to do denial or avoidance or something along those lines. So it's an interesting example of another level of acceptance. And I had sort of an inspiring experience with somebody who's a new resident there on Friday, who has this beatific smile, who is there because she doesn't want to burden her daughter taking care of her at her home. The daughter was willing to do it, and has decided to stop eating because she, you know, doesn't see any point in prolonging things, and she seems quite at peace and fully coherent and, you know, still interested in life. So it's another example of the acceptance.
So you're disagreeing with the part about the bad hair day?
Some time ago you said that the most beautiful people, and they're not interested in how they look and so forth. So, you know, they still seem to be, but they're not worrying about it.
Okay, maybe I wasn't quite clear enough. often that period where people become really beautiful is maybe only the last day or two of their lives. And that people are pointed toward life right up until the very end, and then the last couple of days people point towards death. In a way, the work with people who are approaching death is very, very similar to what we're talking about here. It's work of healing. It's not what exactly the same qualities that will help somebody live well are the qualities that will help you die well. Exactly the same practices that will open you to a beautiful and full death are the practices that will open you to a beautiful and full life. So I don't really think we're in disagreement at all.
Dale, thank you so much. What a great way to end.
Thank you.
Do we have announcements? Well, our speaker next week will be our friend David Lewis. He's
a list for getting on the email list. Lunch, yes. We all meet about 12:30 out in front, so if you feel like getting to know some of your fellow meditators here, that's a really great way to meet people.
Okay. Any other announcements? All right, let's...
Dale. If you want to get on... The Living Dying Project mailing list, you can just go to our website, and there's a very obvious place to get on our mailing list, livingdying.org.
And you have flyers out here as well on some of your upcoming programs. Great. Let's gather in a circle for our dedication of merit.
By the power and truth of this practice, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all be free from sorrow and the causes of sorrow. May all never be separated from the sacred happiness which is without sorrow. And may all live in equanimity without too much attachment or too much aversion, believing in the equality of all that lives.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.